This is The Takeaway for Monday, September 11, 2017.
This is The Takeaway. I'm Todd Zwillick. We're glad to have you with us today. Hurricane Irma, now Tropical Storm Irma, is still battering Florida, although many areas appear to have escaped the worst. After first making landfall in the Florida Keys on Sunday, the storm powered north along the western coast of Florida. Irma has now been downgraded to a tropical storm, as I mentioned, but at one point it packed wind gusts over 140 miles an hour. Almost 6 million people are without power, nearly 60% of the state's customers. Fortunately, millions of people heeded warnings and they fled the state for safety, and that may have saved a lot of lives. Back with us to bring us up to speed on the latest with Irma is Tim Padgett, the America's editor for WLRN Public Radio in Miami. Tim, thanks for coming back.
Thank you.
Tim, I think you're in your own backyard right now for the first time in Miami, right? What are you seeing?
I have just returned from covering the hurricane over the weekend, and what I'm seeing, what I'm surveying, is far less damage than I had anticipated. It's hard to express what a major bullet we dodged here in this state, and particularly in Miami. 3 days ago, we were staring at a Category 5 hurricane barreling practically right up my street into Miami. And I've come back home, and really all I'm seeing is just downed branches and no flooding. It's just a far better scenario than we had ever hoped to come out of.
Well, I'm really happy to hear that, especially in your neighborhood, Tim. Tell us about some of the other areas around Florida, including the Florida Keys and some of the areas that may have been harder hit.
Well, the Keys were badly hit. When Irma made landfall at the Keys yesterday morning, it was about a Category 4 storm. Now, of course, that packs devastating winds, but for the Keys, the real problem is what we call storm surge. It is such a low-lying area there, right smack dab in the middle of the Florida Straits. And what that brings is what we call storm surge, this water of wall that can be just as devastating to property and lives as the wind is. And so now that we are at daybreak here, I think a lot of us are going to be assessing just how badly the Keys, and particularly Key West, got hit in this. One of the fortunate things for the Gulf Coast was that the hit that the Keys took, that landfall helped to break up the storm just a little bit, weaken its center, so that by the time it hit the southwest coast of Florida, it was beginning to diminish, which is why it ran up the coast as a Category 2 storm instead of the Category 4 that we had feared.
And so describe a little bit more about the path after that, Tim. What happened as Irma moved north up the length of Florida?
It began to lose its eye. It hit places like Naples first, and those communities further south, like Naples, did get hit very badly because we are talking about still a very potent storm when it made landfall on the Florida Peninsula. But as it moved up the western coast, as I said, that eye, that very tight eye that Irma had when it was out in the ocean, began to break up, began to diminish. And in fact, by the time it got up to the St. Petersburg, Tampa Bay area, very heavily populated, the eye was almost missing. And that's when we knew that the Bay Area up there, very heavily populated, was also dodging a bullet, because when the storm begins to lose its eye, it just becomes a very bad tropical rainstorm rather than a potent hurricane.
Tim Padgett, you're there in your backyard in the Miami area, but you're also the America's editor for WLRN, and that means you have your eye on the Caribbean. Some of the devastating damage across Caribbean islands may have been lost in some of this American coverage. Can you bring us up to speed on what we know about the total damage now across the Caribbean?
Right. It was worse out on the eastern fringe of the Caribbean, out in areas like the Leeward Islands and the British and U.S. Virgin Islands. Those islands out in the east, particularly the small ones like St. Thomas and St. Martin, were just genuinely devastated. That's where you saw the highest death toll. I think almost 25 people, they have counted, did die in the storm out in that part of the Caribbean. The only good news, really, in the Caribbean was that as it departed those smaller islands out on the Eastern Caribbean, it took a path that left it north of the coast of the bigger islands like Puerto Rico, Hispaniola, which is where the Dominican Republic and Haiti are, and particularly Cuba, although Cuba did get hit a little more directly than we had expected. And that's what you had, a lot of very destructive activity along the north coast of Cuba, particularly in the resort areas there. However, so far we are seeing no reports of deaths. And Havana itself did get very badly flooded in this storm. I think they had to evacuate thousands of tourists in some areas. But again, it could have been worse. And fortunately, we're not seeing any fatalities on Cuba either.
So we're really happy to hear, Tim, that your area of Miami, as you said, dodged a major bullet, but plenty of damage across your state of Florida. What does recovery start to look like now?
Mostly it's the issue of power. As you mentioned, 6 million people, and that number will probably grow, are without power. I think Florida Power and Light here in South Florida, about 85, if not 90% of its customers woke up this morning with no power. And that's going to take days, if not weeks, in some areas to restore. And the last time we had a really major storm here in South Florida was 12 years ago, in 2005, with Hurricane Wilma. And people do remember just how long it took to get their electricity back then. For some, it took months.
Tim Padgett, very happy to hear that your home is okay and that you're okay. Thank you for joining us to bring us up to speed. Tim Padgett, the America's editor for WLRN Public Radio in Miami.
Thanks for having me.
Well, over the weekend, residents across Florida boarded up their homes and tied down boats to guard against Hurricane Irma's destructive high winds. Many cities appear to have been spared the worst, but storm surge is still a major concern in many areas. High tide came and went in the pre-dawn hours, and Floridians were watching closely to see if the passing storm would bring high seas and flooding. Ben Kurtman is here with me now. He's a professor of atmospheric sciences at the University of Miami Rosenstiel School of Marine and Atmospheric Science. Ben, welcome to the show.
Thanks. Thanks for having me on the show.
Let's talk about the storm surge around the coast of Florida. What areas were hardest hit with storm surge? What areas were spared?
Well, the areas hardest hit, I think, are going to be we're going to find out in the as the daylight hours come. The Keys, Key West, Key Largo were hit pretty hard. Naples, of course, is going to have very bad storm surge, and I suspect we're going to see some pretty bad storm surge in Fort Myers. Tampa Bay, we were initially expecting some pretty bad storm surge, but the storm weakened and stayed further inland, and so Tampa Bay was relatively spared. On the other side, there was pretty, 1 to 3 feet of storm surge throughout much of the Miami-Dade County and going up to Fort Lauderdale, so a lot of the coastal zone had, as much as 3 feet of water in streets and river banks. So there's going to be some serious damage throughout the state.
So from the meteorologists and the scientists' perspective, what exactly is storm surge? What happens?
So the simplest way to think about it is the wind is blowing constantly and pushing the water out in front of the storm. And so when the storm comes inland, that wind is on shore. It's pushing the water up onto the land. So what ends up happening is basically the wind is pushing the sea out into the land. You know, if you have 5 feet or 10 feet of storm surge, a house can be completely inundated and, you're swimming in the bottom level.
Well, you work, Professor Kurtman, in Miami. You live and work there. I know that you evacuated from Miami, and we had some officials before the weekend in anticipation of the storm talking about the danger of storm surge to that metropolitan area, not just water coming in over the beach, but water coming up the canals and even in some ways up through the limestone, up through the earth.
That's right. So Miami is extremely, the land is extremely porous. It's almost like a sponge. And so you can, as the water gets pushed into the land from above, it gets pushed in from below. Also, you know, the seawater is more dense than freshwater. So it pushes up the freshwater table from below. And then you have a ton of rainfall coming from the sky. So you can have flooding in very remote areas.
You know, one of the things that we've been asking the scientists who've been joining us over the last couple of weeks as we covered Hurricane Harvey in Texas and now Irma is how much of these events can be attributed to climate change when you look at the data. What do we know about the connection between climate change and storm surge? How are they related?
the way I think about how storm surge and these storms in general are connected to climate change is that we can't blame any specific storm on that storm is because of climate change. But what we can say is the storm may be a little bit stronger. The frequency of intense storms, the magnitude of the Category 3, 4, and 5 storms are going to increase. And the atmosphere is warmer, so it can hold more moisture, so we're going to wring out more rainfall associated with these storms. The ocean is warmer, so these storms have a better fuel source, a stronger fuel source, so they're going to be stronger, which is going to lead to more storm surge. As sea level rises, I mean, there's so many effects. As sea level rises, then, you know, you have another, let's say you have another foot of sea level, add that on top of the storm surge and the wave action, then, you know, you can overtop the coral ridge and that cuts through Coconut Grove, where I live, and have storm surge penetrate all the way through western Miami-Dade County.
Ben Kirtman, you live in Coral Gables. As you mentioned, there's a reef that guards the beach there, and you're watching for the storm surge from your evacuation point. I guess you're in Atlanta right now. Looking down at where you're from, what does it look like in terms of the storm surge and the damage?
Well, I think the worst damage in the places near me are the coastal zones in parts of Coral Gables, Coconut Grove, the Brickell area. We're seeing some street flooding, lots of downed trees and bushes and plants. And so, overall, I think Miami was lucky. The storm initially moved much further west than initially anticipated. And then many other parts of Florida were also lucky in that it stayed inland. We were also very lucky that it lost a lot of strength when it went across Cuba and interacted with the land. So I think we're going to know much better today as we make assessments, and there are going to be some significant costs of recovery. But overall, I think many parts of Florida were lucky. I remain very concerned about the Florida Keys and parts of Naples. I'm very hopeful that we didn't lose anybody, but I am very concerned.
Ben Kirtman, professor of atmospheric sciences at the University of Miami, thank you for being with us.
Thank you. My pleasure.
And we've been hearing from so many of you about your experiences with Irma this weekend.
This is Jermaine from Florida. I'm a nurse in lockdown at a local hospital. We are in the path of Irma. I have family riding it out, seeing if they can save house and animals. I'm afraid for them. It angers me that we have three hurricanes, unprecedented, and people swear global warming is fake.
This is Sophia from Boynton Beach, Florida. I am being impacted by Hurricane Irma. I live in Boynton Beach. I evacuated to Austin, Texas on September 8th to be with my dad and sister, as it was also my birthday on September 9th. My cat is in an animal hospital in Lantana. My car is at Fort Lauderdale Airport. My jet ski is in Delray. My storage unit is in West Boynton. It'll be interesting to see what survives. I'm rooting for my cat. Everything else can be replaced.
I'm rooting for your cat too, Sophia. Your stories and your lives as Irma passes through Florida and heads through the South. Call us with your story. We're at 877-8-MY-TAKE. When you buy a product that says Made in America, that label is supposed to say that what you're buying is helping American workers, and you probably assume under fair conditions, but that's not always the case. Investigations by the California State Department of Labor have found that sewers in garment factories in Los Angeles were making as little as $4 an hour and working up to 11-hour days. Meanwhile, a federal Department of Labor investigation showed that clothing companies like Forever 21 often sell garments for prices way below what they would have to charge if the workers were being paid minimum wage. Now, some of these companies have had to pay back wages or settle with workers after investigations turned up violations. But the companies who sell the clothes, like Forever 21 and TJ Maxx, often don't face penalties at all because of loopholes in the law. David Wiles served as administrator for the U.S. Department of Labor's Wage and Hour Division in the Obama administration. When he was there, he helped investigate some of these cases. He's now dean of the Heller School for Social Policy and Management at Brandeis University.
Well, unfortunately, it's something that has happened and has been a feature of the garment industry for a long time. When I was still at Wage and Hour, we did a set of investigations, random investigations in the garment industry, we found violations in 85% of the investigations we did.
So your agency inspected some of these factories. People call them sweatshops. What kind of conditions are we talking about?
Well, it's the kind of things that, we read about them in history books, and they're still prevalent. They're places where people work long hours, do not receive overtime pay. Very often, they receive way below the minimum wage. There are unfortunately often also unhealthful conditions. There are remaining problems of blocked exits in terms of fire safety. Just a whole range of problems on basic things like pay and standards, but going across onto other things like occupational health and safety. And it is pervasive across the contractors that one finds throughout Los Angeles and Southern California.
And who are the workers, by and large, who are filling these jobs?
Many of the workers are immigrants to the United States, and some of them are undocumented. Unfortunately, their status often leads them to be prey to employers who are undertaking these employment practices that just go against the basic labor standards of our country. And these are workers very often who are afraid to step forward, even when they know full well that they're not being paid according to the laws of the state and the federal government.
But David Weil, there's something that's a little bit tough to understand here. I mean, it's one thing to hear about a grocery store owner or some small business person exploiting an undocumented worker because that worker is desperate. That's illegal. It goes on, and you try to put a stop to it. These are big American companies. Forever 21 has locations all over America. These are big corporate actors, TJ Maxx, other stores. How are they getting away with this kind of behavior?
Really, so many of these pay practices are a result of a supply chain where at the top of the supply chain you have retailers who are paying manufacturers prices well below what those manufacturers need to produce garments in this country that comply with our laws. And that problem then goes to lower and lower levels. Very often you have a manufacturer who might be hiring multiple contractors to do parts of, let's say, sewing operations. And they are paying those contractors at prices below what would be needed, again, to comply with just these basic labor standards. So really, the problem devolves from the retail prices that are being set far too low in terms of what's being paid to the players in the supply chain. And so really, the nub of the problem is something that companies like TJ Maxx, companies like Forever 21 that sit at the top of these supply chains and will continue to rely in part on domestic production, need to acknowledge and build in into what they pay the suppliers of their products.
Are these great big retailers, David Weil, using some sort of loophole that says, you know, we're not manufacturers, we just sell the clothes in order to get around this? Because in the end, it's the workers who aren't being paid their legal due.
That's absolutely right. And unfortunately, what is true in the garment industry is also true in lots of parts of our economy. There are businesses like retailers or even the manufacturers who directly supply them who can say, they're not our employees. We're just contracting for this work. We're not responsible. And therefore, we can turn a blind eye to what's going on. Now, many of the retailers who are involved in sourcing work in Los Angeles have their own codes of conduct that say on paper, we only want to use suppliers who are complying with ethical standards and the legal standards of the country. Unfortunately, often those are paper documents, and the retailers aren't being serious about really trying to source in a way that assures these kinds of practices don't persist.
What has recourse been like for these workers who've been shortchanged?
Well, the Wage and Hour Division has been very aggressive in recovering money. In a set of investigations we did in the garment industry in 2015 and 2016, we recovered more than $1.3 million in lost wages for workers. This is sometimes providing a worker essentially 2 months of the wages that they were really entitled to and didn't receive. The problem, though, is until you root out the practice, until you really address these economics that drive towards this, you're always reacting. You're always trying to recover money as opposed to changing the basic pricing policies that would allow one to proactively make sure people are paid the right amount from the beginning.
Well, Made in America is a popular political slogan here, of course. People like to shop Made in America when they can. Is it possible to have garments made in America long after, you know, most of this industry has already fled to South Asia where labor's cheap?
If companies were simply chasing low wages, they would have left the country years ago. What you're seeing in the remaining industry in Los Angeles is an industry that's really poised to be quick cycle, quick response, fashion-ready production, because there's a great value to that to retailers. And we know of cases of employers who are showing the economics can work, that you can have a viable business that is still sourcing some of your product in the United States, and that you're paying workers responsibly.
David Weil is the dean of the Heller School for Social Policy and Management at Brandeis University and was administrator of the Wage and Hour Division at the Department of Labor in the Obama administration. David Weil, thank you for being here.
Thank you, Todd.
We reached out to both Forever 21 and TJ Maxx, and we got these comments from the companies. From Forever 21, while we don't own or operate the third-party vendors or contractors involved, it is our policy and practice not to purchase merchandise from any company who violates the law. And we got this from TJ Maxx. We've been troubled by allegation of wage violation issues occurring in Los Angeles factories, and we're taking steps to counteract the issues. As the Caribbean was reeling last week from Hurricane Irma, a massive earthquake struck off the southern coast of Mexico. It was the strongest quake to hit that area in a century. Almost 100 people have been found dead so far, mostly in the states of Chiapas and Oaxaca. The magnitude 8.2 quake reduced buildings to rubble. It also shook towns as far north as Mexico City, more than 400 miles away. Paulina Villegas is a New York Times reporter covering Mexico, Central America, and the Caribbean. Paulina, thank you for joining us.
Thanks for having me, Todd.
Describe the damage that was extensive here from Chiapas all the way to Mexico City.
Well, I'm in Oaxaca State, and this is by far the state that has been hit the hardest. I'm in Juchitán, the largest city in this region, which has been hit pretty hard. You can see the damage all over the city. In each street, there are buildings, houses, shattered windows, countless buildings actually that have been completely leveled, including the municipal palace, which collapsed Thursday night. There's still no running water in large parts of the city and surrounding towns. Electricity has been recovered, but not fully. So this city and also the state of Chiapas is still struggling with the aftermath, including countless aftershocks.
Is the rescue phase complete? Are there still people thought to be alive under the rubble?
They are pretty much looking for bodies, but not really any alive. Rescue operations continued throughout the day, yesterday, deep into the night, both here in Juchitán and surrounding towns. But they're basically just looking for bodies that most likely perished after the quake due to the devastation.
Paulina Villegas, you're in the state of Oaxaca now, next door in Chiapas, which was also damaged. That's one of the poorest states in all of Mexico. What has emergency response looked like there? Are crews able to get in there to help people?
Yeah, I think this is the interesting positive sides of disasters. Mexico is used and accustomed to earthquakes. And like you said, both Oaxaca and Chiapas are among the poorest states in the country. But the federal government has responded pretty quickly and efficiently, sending, you know, Marine Army soldiers. There's been a massive deployment of rescuers and working teams that have been sending in food, water, supplies, medical aid. But it's still the largest and the biggest, for sure, challenge that local and state authorities and society here are still struggling with and will continue to do so in the upcoming days and weeks, especially the effort to rebuild cities and towns that have been very devastated and damaged by the quake. But aid and help is coming. There have been strategic operations to send the most urgent help to Juchitán, for example, where the largest number of dead took place in here. So yeah, it's coming, but I also think it's worth noting that society has been coming together and there's many private initiatives by concerned citizens that have been raising funds and just sending all the help they can.
Citizens in towns across southern Mexico recovering now after a massive 8.2 magnitude earthquake that hit last week. Paulina Villegas with the New York Times. Thank you for joining us.
Thank you so much.
And now a story of workplace discrimination and what the government considers discrimination. In July, the Department of Justice filed a brief in federal court saying that the Trump administration no longer views workplace discrimination on the basis of sexual orientation or gender identity to be covered by federal law. Now, that was unnerving news to Americans who've lost jobs or faced discrimination at work because of their sexual orientation or gender identity. And it inspired a new series from WNYC's LGBTQ podcast called Nancy. That series is called Out at Work, and the producers wanted people to share their stories of workplace discrimination. We'll be hearing about one experience of being out at work in just a few minutes, but first we want to look at the protections that are already in place in the United States and why this is such a disputed legal area. Chai Feldblum is a commissioner at the Equal Employment Opportunity Commission, and she explained to me why there's such a patchwork of legal protections for LGBTQ Americans.
What has happened over time is because there is such horrific discrimination against LGBTQ people in employment, is the states have passed laws explicitly prohibiting discrimination on the basis of sexual orientation or gender identity, but not all of the states. So it's completely dependent on where you live, whether you're going to be protected under that state law. And on the federal level, for years, Congress has sought to pass a similar type of explicit law. So people were living in a patchwork of protection. Now, there are various of us, agencies and courts, that are saying, actually, there shouldn't be a patchwork because under the federal law, properly understood, every LGBTQ person is protected under existing federal law.
Now, Chai Feldblum, the Obama administration has taken this position in a case to say that the sex provision of Title VII does include sexual orientation, gender identity. That was the former administration, and now the Trump administration, through the Department of Justice, is taking a different view, and it seems like this very conflict now is playing out in the federal courts.
It is, in fact, unfortunate that at the moment, there is a difference of position being presented to an appellate court in this country from one agency, the EEOC, and another agency, the Department of Justice. However, this is a contested legal issue. The EEOC, as a bipartisan commission with both Democratic and Republican commissioners, have concluded that sex discrimination includes discrimination against gay people as a matter of common sense.
How often does this issue come up before the EEOC where you sit?
Well, just with regard to LGBT people, we've had about 6,000 of these complaints brought to us in the last 6-7 years. We have 3,000 of those currently pending. These charges come to us and we deal with them in a completely confidential manner. We deal with them before anyone even goes to court. And if we think that there was reasonable cause to think discrimination had occurred, we try to settle between the person and the employer.
So the courts are ruling on several different cases around the federal circuits. The EEOC continues with its work. You sound fairly confident from your perch that this is a matter of time, whether through the Supreme Court or through Congress or simply through the quiet work of the EEOC, that sexual orientation and gender identity will continue to be recognized under federal law.
I am confident that in the end, LGBT people will be covered under employment law. I think the most likely way that such coverage will come about is that the Supreme Court will rule that existing sex discrimination law covers LGBT people. However, until and unless the Supreme Court tells us we are wrong at the EEOC, then obviously the EEOC will continue to do its work.
Chai Feldblum is a commissioner on the Equal Employment Opportunity Commission. Commissioner, thank you for being with us.
Thank you so much.
We continue our discussion now about being out at work inside the U.S. military. It's a place where toughness is celebrated and discipline is maintained. And for 17 years, the rules were clear. Don't ask, don't tell. This story comes to us from Nancy, a podcast produced at WNYC Studios. And here you'll meet some of the main players who brought pride to the Pentagon officially for the first time. It's narrated by Kathy Tu.
My name is Todd Brazil. I joined the Army out of college in 1992 as an Army lieutenant in the field artillery. I spent 22 years, 2 months, and 28 days in the regular Army.
And for most of those 22 years, he didn't tell anyone he worked with that he was gay.
For 5 years, I was convinced I could either pray it away or get it counseled away by seeing an Army psychologist. So I thought, well, here's the deal. I will set about creating a life for myself where I have my personal life, and then I'll set up a very, you know, like it's just this impenetrable wall between my personal life and my professional life, and my friends at work will be my friends at work, but they'll never really know who I am, and then my friends outside of work will know the full me. And then I met Mark. Mark and I were substantively engaged. We had exchanged rings for 11 years. For those 11 years, he followed me from assignment to assignment, waited for me while I went off to war a few times, and never received even a courtesy call, let alone any of the rights, benefits, and privileges of a lawfully recognized spouse while I served. What that man went through is something no one should ever have to go through. That hurt me watching what he was going through.
We begin tonight with something brand new in America today. It is day one.
Don't ask, don't tell forced around 14,000 people to leave the armed forces because they are gay.
But today, the 17-year-old policy fought its last battle in the Senate.
With 65 votes, the Senate voted to end the ban on gays serving openly in the military.
Not long after that, Todd was posted to the Pentagon, high up in the communications department.
And just before going, a buddy of mine said, you know, there's this coffee group that meets in the Pentagon. They're all gay. It's civilians. It's people of all ranks. And it's a really great way to network. And you should give it a shot.
We were one part of a little budding gaggle of gays at the Pentagon. My name is Tariq Shah, and I was the Special Assistant to the Assistant Secretary of Defense for Operational Energy. As they say in Washington, the longer your title, the less important you are.
I'm Alex Wagner. I am the former Chief of Staff to the 22nd Secretary of the Army.
Alex and Tariq were civilians appointed by the Obama administration, and they were regulars at the coffee club.
The Pentagon Coffee Group was a group of military officers and enlisted from every service who would come together to create a community within a building that at the time was openly skeptical at best and more likely hostile to their presence in uniform.
Even though Don't Ask, Don't Tell had been repealed, it's not like the military suddenly became a comfortable place for gay people. Alex and Tariq knew that something extra needed to happen for LGBT service members to know it was okay to be themselves. Something public. Something official.
If we could have a pride event at the Pentagon, that would send a message to every single military installation all across the world that you can have one too. If it could be done in the heart of the Pentagon with the most senior uniformed and civilian leaders embracing and endorsing this type of event, it would be something that would be impossible to stop the momentum going forward.
So in early 2012, Alex and Tariq decided that they were going to organize a Pentagon Pride event that June, and it would be the first of its kind.
Tariq and I sat down and we shared a Burger King veggie burger and started plotting how we were going to execute a pride event in the Pentagon way.
The Pentagon way. This part of the plan was crucial. Whatever picture comes to mind when you think of a pride event, this was not what they were going for. For this to work at the Pentagon, it would have to be really square.
Which meant have a ceremony in the Pentagon Auditorium with all the pomp and circumstance, but also with all the respect for tradition and history.
And so this incredible milestone in the history of the Pentagon would be marked by a panel discussion.
My motives here were not to have a pride parade in the Pentagon, but to have an event that resembled every other event the Pentagon held, whether it was MLK Month, Black History Month, Asian Pacific American Heritage Month, in a way that all those people could be proud of it. And so we started plotting. We had to go way outside the chain of command in order to pull this off.
My name is Sue Fulton. I'm an Army veteran.
Sue was a pioneer in her own right as part of the first female class of graduates at West Point in 1980.
For many years, Sue was one of the more prominent voices advocating for repeal of Don't Ask, Don't Tell. Importantly, she also knows most of the Army's senior military leadership, so she had social relationships with many of the senior uniformed generals.
Tariq told me of this ambitious plan to hold a pride event at the Pentagon that June. And I told him, hey, whatever I can do to help, I'd be happy to do. But in the back of my mind, I was thinking, that's too early. It's not going to happen. I had to be persuaded to block the date on my calendar. I was that skeptical. And I'm an optimist. But it just, the Pentagon seemed so foreboding to me at the time. But I also knew that if anybody could pull it off, Alex and Tariq could.
To hear the whole story of how Alex and Tariq pulled off the Pentagon's first Pride celebration, head over to our website at thetakeaway.org. Welcome back. It's Todd Zwillick. And what you're hearing there is Esperanza Spalding making an invitation to her fans not to buy her new album, but to watch it being born.
Exposure.
Esperanza Spalding is about to head into the studio with her musicians to make an album. But here's the thing. They don't have anything prepared. Instead, the Grammy-winning singer and songwriter is planning a 77-hour epic improv session to make the new album, and fans can watch the whole thing on Facebook Live. Esperanza Spalding doesn't have the music for the new album yet, but she does have a title. It's called Exposure, and it's set to come out later this year with only 7,777 signed personal copies available. I spoke with Esperanza Spalding about this project and how improvisation plays out in her music and in her life.
To borrow Wayne Shorter's phrase, he said, composition is improvisation slowed down.
Beauty. Expose yourself.
And improvisation is composition sped up. So we're really going to, I guess, explore the limits of that idea and compose in the spirit of improvisation.
I mean, to me, no preparation feels like being naked in front of your audience.
Well, that's why it's called exposure.
It sure is. There it is.
Yeah, all the way naked. In a way, I think that's our job as creators to really show all that we know and give all that we have. And in this case, the best that we have to give is our performance as composers, as improvising composers, as composing improvisers. So I think, the best format to showcase what it is that we have to give, the totality of what we have to give, is this environment where, yeah, it's a little restrained and it's a little nerve-wracking, but that is a part of improvisation too. Like, you have to have some parameters to feel totally free to improvise. You kind of have to know what the limits are.
Exposure.
Your fans, because there are way more than 7,000 of them, if they want to get in on this, they got to watch it on Facebook Live, because the record's going to be hard to get.
Yeah. Yeah, that's the nature of performance, right? Only 200 people fit into a club, or 500 people fit into a theater, or 2,000 or whatever. And what happens on that night of performance is not repeatable. So, in a way, this is a performance. This is our presentation of the best that we have to give. And it's experiential. So you kind of have to be there, I would say. But we do have the goal of making a record. So you want to be able to give a record to somebody. But I didn't want it to just be this diffused wash across the world, hope people pay attention to it for years to come kind of thing, which is fine. We all make records that way, and I'm sure I will again. But I really wanted this to be like an intimate experience where people get to look into the window. I mean, I can't invite everybody into the studio, so the reason it's live streamed is just so we can do the performance for a bigger audience. But it's almost like if you were in the performance with us, you saw it, and if you weren't, you miss it, and that's okay. That's improvisation too.
See this pretty girl, watch this pretty girl flow.
There's this hokey cliche, it's not the destination, it's the journey, right? And that's a bit overused, but this whole project for you largely is about process and not end product, or so it seems.
Well, it's about both. The mission of improvising isn't solely to be able to come up with something on the fly. The mission is to be able to come up with something on the fly that another person would want to hear and that you want to hear.
Yeah.
You're improvising to create beauty out of whatever happens. Charlie Parker said it was improvisation is the art of recovery, that something happens unexpected and you use improvisation to turn it into something that will keep carrying us forward. And the equivalent of our goal is to, yes, go in and improvise, absolutely. But we want to make beautiful songs.
Have you felt any pressure on yourself, or has anybody talked to you about the intersection of art and politics? Do you want to get into politics? Do you think about it, or is art enough?
The word politics...
just what's going on.
It's very nebulous.
What's going on is what I mean. I don't mean Washington.
There's so much going on. How I identify with what's inside your question is, how do we apply that method of improvisation to really any situation that we're facing? Presuming that the mission of improvisation is to use the known ingredients or the available ingredients, be willing to face them without an agenda and without a plan of how you're going to get to the end of it. Take what's actually happening, respond to what's actually happening, and improvise with your fellow problem solvers to create value with whatever's there. I think we've been practicing that our whole lives as improvisers, and I think that there are definitely applications beyond music for that even worldview or approach to group working or group problem solving. So that's a very kind of top line description of how I see myself interfacing. But I take it as kind of a manifesto. When I see something that is acute and specific, and I realize that I may have access to the resources that could actually affect that and improve that, well, how do I do it? And how do I show how I did it? And how do I learn what didn't work after the fact so that it's better next time? And I've done that kind of process on various issues throughout the years, because more than it's like, what is an artist's responsibility to politics? It's, I'm a person first. So whatever I was doing, whatever my quote unquote career was, I'd be looking for ways to apply my skill set to solve the issues that cause the most suffering to people, to each other, and to our environment. It's in my manifesto.
Well, the new album doesn't exist yet. Then you got to be a lucky person to get your hands on the record afterward, because they'll be only
Well, it's for sale now. I mean, it's for sale anytime. You can
pre-order.
You can pre-order. It's blank.
Make
though.
A bet.
Take a risk, and we will do our best to give you something worth risking.
Well, that's on September 12th at 9 a.m. on Facebook Live, 77 hours in the studio, naked in front of her audience, figuratively, I'm sure.
Yes.
Esperanza Spalding, it's been an enormous pleasure. Thank you for being here.
Thank you.
Esperanza Spalding will create her new album, Exposure, from scratch over a 77-hour period beginning tomorrow, September 12th at 9 a.m. Pacific Time, noon Eastern. And finally today, we want to thank you for calling and writing in with your stories of dealing with Hurricane, now Tropical Storm Irma, throughout the past weekend.
My name is Marissa, and I currently, or used to maybe, live in Dania Beach, and we evacuated to Coral Springs. We still have power right now, but with the multiple tornado warnings, we're all covered up.
This is Gary Bremen from Wilton Manors, Florida, and we are coping with Irma by trying to learn a new board game, which is super hard when the flashlight is hanging from the ceiling, the wind is howling outside, and the cat wants to lay on the board.
My name is Rebecca Ritchie, and I'm calling from Altamont Springs, Florida. I decided, instead of staying home during the hurricane, to go to a shelter in a high school and work with children. And so for 2 days now, that's what I've been doing. And storm is still getting a little bit worse, but we're very distracted as we're having a great time with children and just grateful to be here.
That's Rebecca and Gary and Marissa sharing their stories with us. You can give us your experiences at 8778MyTake. You can always tweet us at The Takeaway. Thank you so much for listening. I am Todd Zwillick. This is The Takeaway.
Support for The Takeaway comes from LegalZoom.com, providing American business owners with legal advice through its network of independent attorneys available in all 50 states. More information available at LegalZoom.com/takeaway. By the Arkansas Economic Development Commission and the state committed to acting quickly and decisively on corporate interests. Learn more about how Arkansas works for businesses at ArkansasEDC.com. Moo, working to help businesses of any size create customized business cards, postcards, stickers, and more. Learn more at moo.com. And Staples, offering print and marketing solutions for businesses, including color copies and presentations, booklets and manuals, signage, and more. More details at Staples stores or staples.com/copy and print. Staples, it's pro time.
At Radiolab, we love nothing more than nerding out about science, neuroscience, chemistry.
But we do also like to get into other kinds of stories. Stories about policing or
politics,
country music,
hockey,
sex of bugs.
Regardless of whether we're looking at science or not science, we bring a rigorous curiosity to get you the answers.
And hopefully make you see the world anew.
Radiolab, adventures on the edge of what we think we know.
Wherever you get your podcasts.